Good morning. Welcome to this session in the arts track. I'm Dana Gioia. I am the director of the Harmon Eisner Program in the Arts at the Aspen Institute. And it's my pleasure to introduce what I think is a sensational panel on public sculpture and private creativity. Leading the panel is Adele Chatfield Taylor, who is the president of the American Academy in Rome. It has been someone who, across her entire career, has been involved, in art and design. In fact, some years ago, before I got to the NEA, she was the director of design at the NEA, which is a very broad subject, which includes architecture, as well as the other aspects of design. And with her today is Janet Eckelman, who literally, as we sit here, is having a public work being installed in Denver. I think you're going to duck out tomorrow to oversee the installation. And then one of our two Harmon Eisner artists in residence, the sculptor Guy Dill. So, I don't think we could possibly have gotten a better panel. And I know that Adele has prepared enough material for a mini series on public sculpture. So I can't wait. So welcome.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. Before we even begin, there's not that much going on about art in this amazing Ideas Festival. There's so many subjects. But I want to draw your attention to a marvelous exhibition that's right outside the door here in the Resnick Gallery, and that is Contemporary Latin American Art. And I think you'll enjoy it, so be sure to look on your way in and around. Thank you for coming. I'll just build on Dana's brief introductions of our two speakers and say that we've got Guy Dill here on my right, who lives and works in Venice, California, and has been on the West Coast for a great deal of his professional life with Mary Ann, who lives right there. who's sitting right there. He's a sculptor of a great many types of work and many scales, and that includes the whole range from public art to monumental art to small private works that can be found in private collections. He's collected and shown all over the world, and he has won numerous awards and fellowships that are too numerous to iterate, but you can read about him in your conference materials, so I won't repeat all of that. Janet, as you just heard, is a very different kind of sculptor who makes monumental work, but out of material that responds to wind, water, and sunlight, including the largest public art project in the United States that she produced for Phoenix. She's also a recipient of many awards and prizes. I thought, though, it's imperative to show you what their work looks like. So we'll begin with a brief presentation from Guy, and then move right away to a brief presentation from Janet, so that you'll have in your visual imagination what we're talking about. So, Guy, let's begin with you, and we'll get off stage so that everybody can see.
Good morning. I'm glad everyone... Can I help you with that? Good morning. My name is Guy Dill, and I am so happy to be here. This is the most stimulating place I think I've ever been in my life. This week has, it has been globally stimulating in the sense that I'm learning more than I ever knew. I'm so glad to be off the newspapers and out of the radio and television and be with the likes of you all. By way of presenting who I am so that we can have a discussion about what really interests Janet and I and hopefully this audience is public art and how we see it today and what is it to an artist to come from the studio and deal with the public at large and be a part of the fabric of society ultimately? I'll show you some photographs. I'm not going to give you a retrospective. That's coming on Sunday at 9 o'clock, which Dana will be. We'll have a conversation with Dana in Pepke, and I believe that's at 9 a.m. So we'll really flesh it out then. These are just basically some indicators. I have my background. I didn't come to art as is typically understood. I didn't draw as a child. I couldn't care less about it. I spent my time in the water. And I lived in a place where I lived on the beach, and water was everything to me. And I surfed and I sailed. And I went to high school. And it was Vietnam, and it was either go into the Marines, get into college, or join the Coast Guard, which was a non-combative element of the government at that time. Considered a military service, however, combat was voluntary. So I chose the latter, and because I could be on the ocean, I could be at sea, and then I could become an authority at what I did. And I was very interested in marlin spike seamanship initially, and I spent 4 years in the Coast Guard, and 3 years of it was on a buoy tender, hauling out 20-ton objects. Buoys are very interesting objects because it's mostly below the water, and putting them on the deck of a rolling ship. The physics involved and the danger involved and the sheer drama involved in working in that kind of environment affected me throughout my life. Went on to become a navigator in the Coast Guard and then ultimately into public relations. During that period, I signed on to a schooner, and we were going to make a trip around the world. So we were restoring the schooner to take off. And at night, I'd been visiting some friends at Chouinard Art Institute, which was a college that Nellie Chouinard and Walt Disney started to train animators for Walt and to train painters for Nellie Chouinard. She brought out instructors from Black Mountain College, and I would visit friends there, and I'd draw occasionally. A professor encouraged me to put a portfolio together. I thought nothing of it. I left. I was on the East Coast on a ship back there that I was going to start a charter business with. I got a call from my mother at one point, and she had a letter which was from the college, and apparently I had gotten in. They wanted to give me money. And basically, it was the end of my days at sea because it was my shot at college. So at the age of 21, I started college, and with no intention of becoming an artist. That was not why I went. It was the wonderful dialogue I had with students. There was a language, and I understood that language. And as abstract as it was, I really got a handle on it. These slides should illustrate some of this. These are very early. I graduated in 1970. And I did what I knew how to do. My degree's in painting, but I really was in need of the physical world. I could not leave that behind. So I did what came absolutely naturally to me, and I started building. And basically, I was making ship parts, but they seemed natural to me. Only the difference was that I'm inside a room, and I have to deal with that room. So these early works were really based on pulling on the architecture, the walls, the floors, et cetera. And the statement was about material. It was about stress. It was about holding, gravity, all the things that that I'd come from, that I'd relied on for all of my information. The information before college informed all that I did throughout college. I mean, there's a point at which you say, what is your origin? How did you get, why did you become a sculptor? Why are you an artist? And for me, it was about expressing a language. And early on, I was able to express myself because there were a lot of empty warehouses in Venice, and it was an easy thing to do to get a big space and to make big work. The way you are on a ship is that you consume all the space available to you because it's finite. The way I was in a warehouse building or studio is I consume the space because that's all there is for me. So architecture became very important early in my career, and fortunately it was available. I think real estate is important for artists, less so now for certain artists, but always they need that place in which to work. Once I started outside the building, the works, by the way, these are all way pre-digital, so these are transferred into it, and so we get some grain going. As I started working outside, because at one point I lost a studio and I had no choice but to find a vacant lot somewhere and build what I could. The work became more insular. It talked about itself. I'm outside and I'm thinking about how materials connect, what they do, you know, what does that have to do with me? What does that have to do with itself? And how can I make things work without walls? So the interdependence of things, which is as simple as this, bless you, is what could be manifested in any kind of material. These are Douglas fir beams that they interlock. And that's as simple as it is, but the form to me was dynamic enough to pursue. Okay, Dana, this is an interesting piece that I had not a chance to show you yet. This is at Wright State University, and the NEA contacted me quite out of the blue and said, we understand you have a problem. You want to make big work, but you can't get a commission because you've never done big work, and we know you have a catch-22. We have a position at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. Right there, I got a little worried. Ohio, it was a little far from the sea. And if you could be their artist in residence, teach a class and build a monumental piece, we'll fund it. I jumped at that chance, and I went out to Wright State and used the students and built a piece of some considerable scale. It was a great learning experience, and it showed me that my theory about what could happen, I could make happen. There was a point at which I gained a lot of confidence. Subsequent works, I think we're into 1972 now. The piece I just showed you was a bit later, but 1972. Casting slabs, punching through, using gravity, an interior operation of an independent piece. So outside, back to inside, and how does that behave? I cast the slabs right on the site, tilted them up, and this piece repeats itself quite a few times in my career. This is in Queens, actually. It's Socrates Sculpture Park. Mark de Souvereau hosts artists to come out and build a piece. And he gets very involved. He's a real art hog. You cannot do it alone. He'll do the welding. He moves the crane around. It's quite interesting how he jumps on it. An idea being pursued into a monumental state. Okay, this really had propelled me into a place where monumental work had an impact on you as a human being. I mean, you can feel, these are 14 by 14 foot slabs. They're 7 inches thick and there's a tremendous amount of weight. And being able to prop these up, and when you take a material, you pull it out of context, it has a different kind of meaning. That was basically the thrust of what I was doing. The glass panels, the metal panels coming off the wall, these slabs tilted up. Everything is sort of wrong, and it makes you wonder why. What is that about? Why did this artist choose to put these in this kind of position? It's no different to me, though, than working in a very quiet atmosphere. There's a dynamic that exists, and I'm always looking for that tension between shapes, between systems. There's none of the tools I used before, such as gravity and tension and stress, are employed here. But yet I'm now looking for some other kind of tension and stress and a different compositional element. This is a period of work that was post in lintel period. How's my time? Am I running long? Pick it up. Okay. So a post in lintel period, and these were the first ones were in private situations. This is one of the first studio buildings I built to house the work. So I didn't have to work outside anymore. Marianne and I put this together, and I finally had a place to work where I couldn't be evicted. This is in Tokyo. The hard part about going short is there's a long story for every one of these, but I'll see if I can stick to it. Finally, that series manifested itself in a very large piece called Igalma from the Epic of Gilgamesh. There's a number of quite lofty characters, and Igalma means the great palace, and this was basically the period at the end of this series, and these were all post-tension work, about 180 tons of concrete. This will give you some idea of the scale of what I was working with here, and it was a prudential commission that I could do something like this because this in an urban area is a skateboard park, essentially. It becomes that. But it was Department of Defense on one side and then some other federal building on the other. So it was 24-hour guards, and the skateboard kids didn't have access to it, which I wish they did. Work from the studio that becomes quasi-public, privately owned but publicly seen. Very difficult thing to do, not my favorite thing to do, but yet you have a client sometimes, and sometimes it works. This was sheltered enough from the street that it was a great entrance for them every time they came back. Same here. This is a great house. This is a the guy who designed the Oscar.
Cedric Gibbons.
Right. A fantastic Art Deco house. And okay, now this is where. This actually is where. This is Ace Gallery in Los Angeles, and I did this installation there. And we're now at the point of the work really needs to go outside. We get the scale, the impact, all of this, and ultimately this piece now resides in a at a private hospital in Florida. And I won't talk about context yet, but it works where it is, and it really kind of started to throw me outside and think more about what's going on with these works outside. This is downtown Los Angeles, if you recognize it. So the work really needs, to me, is like a small pavilion that has a meditative quality and enough curiosity so that you go to it, and when you're there, what do? You get to think about it or something else. However, there is you've arrived at something. Las Vegas. This is at the Oudon Castle in Ghent, in Belgium. I worked a number of years in the 90s when everything went flat for artists in the United States. I had a wonderful dealer in Belgium, and I had a great fun time with Flemish collectors, and they made me the American guest at this exhibition. And the counterpoint between this castle and the work I do was terribly exciting to do. Those forms later manifested itself into a public work where I was able to design the park. And initially what happened was, this is where people went to smoke. It's surrounded by cars, and it's an island. And then ultimately they chased the smokers out because it became a meditative place to walk up and down. And what happens actually on the right-hand side, the sidewalk... when you're there, narrows. There's a way I did. I changed the perspective so it was backwards. So as you, the hedge actually is taller at the other end, and the sidewalk doesn't narrow, and so there's this deadening. There's actually a big black disc, if you can see it, at the end, which is the end of the walkway. There's a lot of small events that occur within this work, so it was a real relief for people in the building to come out and discover it and give it their own connotation and meanings. It's the entrance to a music campus, a Sony music campus. The work's about 40 feet wide, and you actually walk through the piece to get inside. There's an intercom there, and they buzz you in, and that tilted record opens up. And it's not a record. I didn't think about it that way, but it's very heavily musical because of those forms fit in with my forms. There's really no music. It's just arcs and discs and half circles, etc.
Okay, let's get to the end.
Okay, to the end. Pictures.
Beautiful.
Oh, by the way, I'll just make a comment on this. It's only 10 feet high. But where you come up on the hill, there's a little, this is in right outside of Brussels, and the little cars, it's up high enough, you're in a little car, everything works well. It's those circles where you look at the map again, decide where you are, and it's something to look at while you, we'll talk about that later, those computer-driven cutouts above, which are very useful to me. Building it first in cardboard, full scale, with a glue gun, there's nothing more fun than that. Patina application to a final work. And then this is the final work I'm showing you, which is now in Bell Harbor. And it's 11 tons of bronze, it's about 33 feet high. And this was the initial stage, just looking at what I'm gonna do to an installation photograph, and then back to a model, because you got to sell these things, and the construction of the piece in Madison, Connecticut, because there was a great fabricator there. I couldn't handle it in my studio. It was just far too big. And it was an exciting installation. We broke all the union rules because they wanted to see it up, and they were so curious about it that they worked through the night. We were on two cranes, and finally we resolved the piece. And as you're looking up through it, that's the final slide.
Thank you.
Terry.
Thank you. We'd look at that all day, just to give you a taste. And now let's have Janet also as simply as you can, so that we can then talk about it.
If I sit here, then it will. I don't
can't
want to block the images.
Can't hear you.
Okay. Adele asked us to, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Asked us to tell a little bit about our narrative. So I found this old photo. Like Guy, I grew up with no active painting or drawing. I was trained as a classical pianist, and at age 14, I found myself a piano soloist with the Florida Orchestra playing Grieg's Piano Concerto. And when it came time for college, I knew that classical music was not my calling, and I went off to Harvard College and became a documentary filmmaker and took an introduction to drawing. So with a semester of drawing and painting behind me, I set out to go live in Asia on my own after college. And I moved first to Hong Kong for a year, where I studied Chinese calligraphy and brush painting with the support of a foundation, and then moved on my own to Bali, Indonesia. This is the rice field beside my home. And I found out that an American artist, who some of you may have heard of, Robert Rauschenberg, I had not studied contemporary art history, and I didn't know his work. I knew his name, but I didn't know his work, and he was looking for someone in Asia to organize his exhibitions. So he hired me because I was living in Bali, and when I was guiding him, he asked if he could see what I did, and I showed him. This was my first painting that I made living in Bali. It's a combination of batik, dyeing of the canvas with painting. And he said, he asked if I'd mind if he could organize a solo exhibition in the States. And I said, okay. I was 23. Really didn't know what was going on. And he had a very big influence that I wouldn't realize for about a decade later. This particular piece I'm showing you, this triptych, was shipped off to the States and then framed on stretchers. And at the opening, he bought it for his collection. And he said that he wanted to take it off the stretchers because letting it be free in a space, it would actually interact with the air currents in the room. And let's fast forward. Is that it? 7 years later, my house in Bali, I was invited to go back to Harvard to teach a course, and I sublet my home in Bali, and the person accidentally burned it down. So I was, and this was the painting I made of looking back at that rice field I had just shown you, and sort of the memory of all the experiences there. And I think you can see the influence of the Chinese calligraphy study, and that the work was becoming about pure gesture, pure movement. And then I'll fast forward another 7 years. I went to India on a Fulbright to teach painting because I was a painter. And they tell you to ship your academic materials. And so as an artist, I thought, well, paint is my academic material. So I shipped it through the diplomatic pouch. And it was the time where Jesse Helms had eradicated funding for art exhibitions. And the embassy in India said, we have funding for one more exhibition. Will you do it? And I said, sure. And I was planning to make a series of large paintings in India during my Fulbright. And fast forward, the paint never arrived. So there I am in a foreign culture to me with no materials, and I decided to embrace what was there rather than hit my head against a wall. And so I started making my way through the Indian craft traditions. I learned vegetable dyeing and stamping and all kinds of traditions. And finally, I was in this village, which is called Mahabalipur. Is that a pointer? No. But you can see these famous stone temples on the shore near Madras or Chennai. And I decided to learn what they do there. And they make bronze, which they've done for 1,000 years. And it was just 10 weeks before the exhibitions were to open. I had no paint still, and I had a dozen bronzes that could each fit in my hand. And they had rented these very large gallery spaces, and I just was beside myself. And every day after I left the bronze foundry, I would go for a walk on the beach here. It was a block. And I'd go for a swim for exercise. And it was just at the time the fishermen were bringing in their nets. And there were these hulking volumetric forms on the beach. And I thought, there's another approach to volume without weight, without mass. And the embassy didn't have much of a travel budget. So this also allowed me to fold it up like a nomad and then to create big work. And so this was the first piece I made. And these are three more of that. And you can see the bronze portions that I eventually discovered were not central to the idea that it was about this responsiveness and interaction with its environment. And we'll fast forward. I was invited to a museum in Lithuania called the Museum of the Center of Europe. And I didn't know what I would do there. But they introduced me to a lady who makes doilies in her kitchen. And she turned out that the knotting traditions I learned from the Indian fishermen are the same knots as they use in Lithuania for lace. And so I learned about these different patterns. This piece is called Trying to Hide with Your Tail in the Air. And it's a permanent piece in the museum. I was invited to Japan and worked, this is in Kyoto, on the Philosopher's Path in one of the Buddhist monasteries, and they invited me to work with their gardener to create a work there. There are pieces coming up from the water that don't respond or change, and there are pieces that suspend down that are responding to their environment. All of this work, I'm seeking a shared visual language in the place where I am. And I think coming from the United States, where public education doesn't teach art history, say if you compare that to a European country, where, as I think someone was saying, even your taxi driver, Dana was saying, the taxi driver knows the history. So in the United States, I was invited to do my first piece, and the site was the Interstate Highway in Houston. In fact, it was the first time permission was granted to do a piece on infrastructure, and the organization that invited me went through great political process to get permission. And I thought, what am I going to do? I've been working in these very rich craft traditions. What will I do? What is the shared visual language in the United States on a highway? And I said, well, the orange safety cone is a shared visual language. The black and white dotted line is a shared visual language. And I went to a truck tarp manufacturer and worked with them to create this piece, the Roadside Shrine series. And this is a public jogging path and bicycle path, and they told me that this area where the highway crosses had been a dangerous zone, that people were uncomfortable when they went through, and that when the art was there, they felt safe. So it created an intended space and actually created safety, which I thought was an interesting corollary. And I also think of it as animating or humanizing infrastructure. And the name of the, well, we'll go on. We'll move along. My first invitation for a solo exhibition in New York City was at a gallery in Chelsea. And I was very excited, but then I didn't know what in the world I wanted to do in the gallery. And finally, I realized I wanted to steal the public space. So the entire work happened outside of the windows. and the only thing that happened inside the gallery was the reflected colored light. It's called Cones on 29th Street. And I was invited by a city in Florida, in Tampa, Florida. They have a concrete garage that blocks their waterfront, and they asked me to transform it for people. And so that's an example of transforming infrastructure. And this was a piece, I was invited to Spain, to Madrid, and this is a round courtyard in their National Trade Complex. And I thought of the circular courtyard as a reference to the bull ring, and I was thinking of Jasper John's target series. And so, and the fact that the middle of a target is called the bullseye. So this is target swooping down bullseye. And this is a photo from an airplane. And this is the building that you come through. And that piece began to travel like a nomadic work. This is a historic building in Spain where Christopher Columbus was welcomed home by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. And it then traveled to Rotterdam in the Netherlands, to Art Basel in Miami Beach. And this was where I made it in India, where I think of it as a drawing, a floor drawing. This is in New York City, the Museum of Arts and Design, a piece called The Expanding Club, which happened at the time North Korea detonated its first nuclear test. And this is composed of the colors of the flags of each country that has detonated a nuclear weapon. And then I was invited to do my first major permanent commission. It happened in Europe. It was part of funding for cultural infrastructure, and they were funding major projects. And I was given this site. Let's see. Go ahead, you can see some of the engineering. Oh, I want to give you there's a detail. Well, the site, they gave me five criteria I had to meet. It had to be a symbol that united their entire waterfront and could be visible 1 kilometer in every direction, including from the sea, but not block the views of the waterfront from all the condominiums. It had to withstand hurricane winds, about 90 miles per hour, had to resist pollution and salt air, be built on time and on budget. And we did it. It's an industrial area, so the red and white stripes are references to the smokestacks in the area, and it's an area where the fishermen have had a hard time of late, and they have embraced the piece. When they took it down for cleaning, they had to put up a billboard to tell people when it would come back. And I understand in the soccer stadium, the name of the town, and they now have like a little silhouette of the piece. So they've really, it's become part of their identity. They don't need to know my name. It's their piece now. And this piece shows you an important part for me, which are the shadow drawings that are cast upon the ground and that you and I, as we walk or in our cars, become a part of the work as the shadows come over our bodies and our cars. And there you can see the scale, and it's illuminated at night and becomes a civic beacon. In terms of scale, it's 160 feet across from the steel ring, and it's 100 meters diameter between the armature, which is... the structure is steel and steel cabling, and the sculptural form is Teflon fiber. So it's 100% UV resistant. I was invited to do a piece for the Vancouver Winter Olympics on a site that is a neighborhood primarily Chinese. And move along, okay. I developed this piece, a water garden with sky lanterns and a red bridge that wanders through. And we'll talk a little bit more about technology, but this shows you my modeling process, my work with engineers, finite element analysis that we developed specifically for my work, and another piece there at the Winter Olympics ice skating oval. And this is more about the technology, installation. I work with roller coaster manufacturers to bend the steel There you can see the relationship with people and the material. Again, it's Teflon. They were looking for a place to welcome the Emperor of Japan, and they decided this was the place. So this speaking across cultures and using visual language. And illumination. And this is the piece Adele referred to that opened in Phoenix, Arizona last year. I was invited. They had two city blocks in the middle of downtown, and they wanted to revitalize their downtown. And they told me they wanted one major event that could be seen from a particular new street they're developing. And that's the piece. I have 20 different lights, each with a different colored glass lens. And through the year, different lights turn on and off very slowly. So it has a seasonal change. Within a night, you don't notice any difference, but you get the work. My goal is that you have a relationship with the work that is as dynamic as a marriage, that you know, you might look back on different moments in your life and remember how the sculpture looked. These are the engineering drawings. Where it's red, we have to adjust to reduce the stress. The blue and purple zones are the, you can see all the modeling of each. Because I was a painter, I mix color the same way I did as painting, only now with fiber. I do wind modeling. So this is what it looks like when there's no wind, just self-weight, 30, 60, 90 miles an hour. I have to also deal with earthquake and seismic zones. These are some of the details. Guy and I share an interest in sailing, and that's really old technology and new technology, both together. That's the factory. There's the piece. And this is the piece that will open this week in Denver, the new software I developed for it. And some pieces you'll see in the future. A piece will be opening at San Francisco Airport. A new piece for Philadelphia for their City Hall. And I'm just going to put on some silent video because the work is all about experience. I can't tell you about it. It's about being underneath it and just physically, non-verbally experiencing it. Like a moment from your childhood. And so we'll run the DVD if we can. And then I'm ready for... I don't know if this is the right one. You know what? That's not. That's not the right DVD. So maybe we'll... Oh, there it is. Okay. We'll just give you a moment to understand the interaction. I work with aeronautical engineers. And I design it to create a contemplative experience for the viewer that you might be able to spend some time in a public place and have your own experience of it.
Is it wind making the changes?
Completely wind. So it is different on every day and at every time.
Does it make a noise?
There is sound, which obviously is different depending on the weather. Just the sound of the wind, just like, you know, if you listen to an aspen tree.
So just shush kind of?
Yeah. Louder in heavier winds. Okay.
Well, let's leave that on.
Where is that piece going in
Denver? In downtown Denver, it's attached to the Denver Art Museum. It's laced into the Ponte building, into the top of the building, over the street, 14th Street, into their civic center.
So it's a permanent installation?
It actually is for the Biennial of the Americas. It's only for this month, and it will... come back for the biennial, but the opening is on July 8th.
And is it city funded or who funded
it? It is funded by the city. It's the signature commission of the city for the Biennial of the Americas.
Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
I think I did a terrible thing to our speakers, which was to ask them to start with
our title is Public Sculpture and Private Creativity. I asked them to start with their private story of how they got into art, whether it was something they were thinking about as children. And it's a dirty trick because you can't really say it that fast. So thank you for doing so well and giving us this delicious taste. I'm very struck by the fact that so much of this conference is about technology and this sort of tsunami of change that we're getting, hearing about Twitter and Facebook and all of this, and how opposite this is to those experiences. These are things that bear study and contemplation and really looking at year after year and lifetime after lifetime, preferably. But I did want to note that both artists are very, very dependent on technology, in addition to their ultimate effort, which is a handmade object. And I don't know if you want to comment further on that or whether we should go right to public art. I think that it's pretty manifest in everything you've shown us that you use technology in ingenious ways.
Well, you know, one thing I would add is that initially when it was everything was technology and art is moving to technology, I had a built-in fear. I thought I had to make art with the technology. Ultimately, what happens is that it's a great assist. It's a tremendous assist in everything I do. And now it's my ally, and I have no fear of it, except that I can't learn enough about it.
And I love the way Janet puts it together, I mean, in such a vivid way, not only designing her own software to make those pieces, but also combining that with sewing that you do with your fingers. I mean, it's a divine combination as far as I'm concerned. So you couldn't do it without both of those.
Oh, the engineering team is critical because these are physical pieces in the world above people's heads and cars and you know, every single piece of twine is analyzed. But the old technology, the fishing net, has got to be one of the oldest technologies. Mm-hmm.
And but made by hand. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful.
We're grateful
High
for
and low.
All the engineering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Let's turn to politics and community and public art, because you've both done so much of it. You represent very different generations in your own careers and are both producing very visible work for the public realm all around the world, actually. I wanted to point out, though, that Americans learned the most about public art probably through an experience and a 10-year debate that raged around a site-specific art in New York known as the Tilted Arc, which was a site-specific Richard Serra sculpture that was commissioned by the federal government, the General Services Administration, to be specific. And it did that in 1979, and it involved a budget of $175,000 in taxpayers' money. When it was installed that year, or soon thereafter, it was despised by a large number of people who worked in the building in which it, in front of which it was positioned. It caused such an uproar, and there was such a petition and a debate that went around the entire country that the work was removed in 1989. This is an unprecedented act for a site-specific sculpture commissioned by the same party that then removed it. And it prompted us, when we were talking about this panel, to talk about the role of an artist. And in the early 20th century, all the way through the Second World War, I would say, it would be fair to say that the artist understood his job to be making an aesthetic expression of what the community in which he was working, he or she, had a feeling about something. And the job was to express that feeling, whether it was youth who were lost during a war, whether it was a visit of a president, or whether it was a favorite son or daughter making good and being memorialized in some way. And I remember conversations with Walker Hancock, who was a person who did a great deal of this work, mostly memorial. And he said that it was not a question of him expressing himself, but rather this community emotion, and that he would present it to members of the community with whom he was working. And they even would sometimes tweak it so that it would better express the feeling that he was trying to capture, to present to them. So it went without saying that that exercise led to a lot of communal acceptance of the piece. Very different from what we found in the Tilted Ark story, when we had a vision of one man in a very uncompromised picture of what he thought this site demanded. I dare say that the building in front of which it was built was very ugly, really an extremely trying addition to that part of New York downtown near City Hall. And I think this was sort of a well-established description of it, that it was not a beauty. So it's possible that Richard Serra was trying to react or was reacting to that when he designed the Tilted Ark. But it was a turning point for all of public art that was installed before or after. There are a lot of artists who would not participate in public art projects thereafter because of their fear that it would be removed. But we've discovered that Guy and Janet both had public art stories, and I think they match the generations in which they've been working. So let's start with Guy telling us about yours in North Dakota.
North Dakota, Huron, North Dakota. I was invited to Huron, South Dakota. It wasn't exactly Tokyo or Vancouver, but it was the same federal program that Richard Serra did his was funded by the federal government, GSA at the time. And this was what they do essentially is put an artist in a different part of the country or outside of their usual context of placing art. So you're selected by, there's a huge database that they introduce artists to an area. And then some of the builders and some of the people who are the movers and shakers of a community look at that and they select a range of artists. And you go through the process of being interviewed, et cetera. So I was selected to do this work for Huron, South Dakota. I flew out there and I looked at it and I saw that this place was a very, it's a serious place to live. I mean, their winters are very long. It's a life and death. It's wheat and beef, 15,000 people, and pretty no nonsense. And the first thing I noticed, and driving into town, to get there took, you know, an entire day and a half almost, because you have to get on smaller and smaller planes till you're finally there, was that all the tractors were overlapping and lined up in this beautiful rhythm, and all the tools were lined up in these beautiful kinds of rhythms because they need to be able to get at whatever they need. It's subsistence, and everything they had was organized, and you could tell there was no excesses anywhere. You know, the John Deere factory was here. Showroom was here stacking their equipment just like a private farmer would stack his equipment. And I was really moved by how organized everything was and then realized this is a life and death kind of place. So the work I did, at first I did a model that was presented at the Smithsonian. And
how did it happen that they chose to do a piece in that part of the world?
Well, at the time, for each American, it was about 6 cents per capita for funded art. And here on South Dakota, there was a postmaster there. Ah, it's a federal building. When they build a federal building, I left that. That's pretty critical. And they are required to have work of art. It's like the percent for art in certain cities in the U.S. So I built the model. The model was then seen by the newspapers in Huron, South Dakota, and got into the hands of some private citizens who built their own models, put them on the lawn when they found out how much the work cost. It was, I think the total cost of the piece was $26,500, which at that time was the price of the most expensive Victorian home in Huron, South Dakota. This outraged the citizens. They built their own models of my work, and they burned them. And the Washington Post got a a handle on this. And there was a Congressman Abner needed he needed something to give him a little boost in, with the public. So this was a real interesting football they were throwing around. And CBS called me and said, "Can we do something with you?" And I said, "No, I really don't want to because I don't know how I feel about this yet." And he said, "Well, one thing you should do is let the fires keep burning. You can't buy this kind of press," which I, you know, so there's all, funny pressures coming from everywhere. This is my first really public work, federally funded, and they finally, it got to be such an uproar. Donald Thaliker, head of the program at the time, said, "Would you go back and talk to the citizens of Huron?" And I said, "Not without one of you guys." And so Donald flew.
Police escort.
Please, the pitchforks and torches were out. I was really... I was worried, and I got there, and I did two radio shows. I did a television show and a town hall forum where I showed slides, and I talked about my work. I talked about this work. I talked about them. I talked about myself as an artist, and there was a guy in the audience. His name was, Mr. Roth from Roth's Plumbing and Heating. He managed to gather up 5,000 signatures to have the piece removed. And it was already installed. And at the end of this meeting, Mr. Roth stood up and volunteered to clean the piece after each nasty storm. And it turned the public around just to be there and remove the fear. It's like, what is this thing? Why is it here? Who are you? Why are we paying for it? When I told them it cost them 6 cents each, they were fine with it. But it was still that fear. What is this thing? So, you know, there's a book about this, actually, that is Art and Architecture is the name of it. And Donald wrote this book, and there's story after story after story. I mean, like Janet's work became the logo on their stationery, mm-hmm. and this has happened in Pittsburgh. It's happened in Chicago. It's happened in many places where federal judges have, like, wanted the work removed. And the tragedy of the scary part of removing the Richard Serra piece was that it set a precedent. Does that mean a permanent work of art can be moved? And fortunately, it hasn't happened after that, but that was all our big fear at the time.
How do you feel about those commissions now?
Well, you know, I'm the same way I am. What it did was actually focus me more on, how can I put this? It's a kind of focus that meant that I could do my work and it's can be legitimately received. I mean, there's a lot of other information that goes with public art. I hope we can get into this. But it actually gave me a kind of confidence. It gave me a kind of fear and confidence at the same time because I knew that most places where you put in work, you're going to have a tsunami of resistance for this to happen. Once I knew that there's another side to this, I was able to proceed pretty, you know, with a lot more confidence, actually.
But it's so interesting that communicating what it was and sort of defusing the fear of the unknown was such a big part of that.
It was a huge part of it. I mean, you know, you take out the fear and people are okay with everything. You know, then they can experience what it's about.
Janet, you missed the Tilted Art controversy because you were in Bali, I think, at that point. And but you have a very big appetite for public art and finding a language that you can invent that solves the problem and delivers the thing that they're asking for, in a sense, but that also enables you to keep your sophistication and fit your piece and the way you work into the long history of art. Can you talk a little bit about that? And are you aiming at making something beautiful? Or are you aiming at making something... Is it all about making it seen, being seen from a mile away? Or tell us what you do to communicate the way Gil Guy did with the community after the fact, but it led to a happy ending. Tell us the story of the Phoenix piece, because that was almost a tragedy, but saved by the bell.
A couple of years, many of you will remember when the economy began to implode in places like Phoenix first. This piece, I had designed it, and it was time for the city council to approve it, and it was canceled because it was a time they were suddenly cutting firemen and teachers, and how could they be seen spending
millions of dollars on a work of art in such an exposed manner. And I think they thought it would fade away. And what happened is that the
public... What was the budget?
$2.5 million. There were protests. And the public said, you know, this is our artwork. It's gone through our arts commission and our public process, and you can't cancel it. And so they called for a hearing, and 100 people showed up at City Hall in the middle of a work day with placards. You know, I support the Eckelman sculpture. And all but one were speaking in favor of the sculpture. And it went to a televised vote, and it was voted in favor to proceed. So, and I think an important aspect was that it was not one coalition. It was not the arts community alone that were calling for this, that the Downtown Business Coalition came with formal support, that they felt this would be an economic revitalizer of downtown. And I think it was the broad base of support that made this piece go forward and become, you know, a reality today. And it has, I mean, it was a risk on behalf of those who helped support it, and it just won the People's Choice Award. So, you know, it was a very risky piece in a place like Phoenix, and it became a kind of identity, you know, like we are a city of culture now. We can do this. And so it was a very important moment for the city.
What year was it?
It opened last year, 2009.
This is Jenna, a long story.
Did you feel that being accountable was important? Do you think that was probably some of the key? Because you were there, and you were responsive to everything, and you were.
I think, you know, the true test of whether a work will survive and be cared for is not your contract. You know, your contract can say it cannot be moved and it must be maintained, but the real test is if people love it. If they love it, they will care for it. The Eiffel Tower was meant as a temporary work.
That's right.
And you can't imagine Paris without it. It requires immense maintenance. And so I think as artists, Tilted Arc was pivotal for me because I was a young artist. You know, my work is sort of like the opposite. You know, Tilted Arc blocked the view of the people who worked in that building, and my work you see right through it. So it.
We have a comment or a question here.
Are you from Phoenix?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh.
I got a call early one morning, and they said to me,
oh, thank you. I got a call early one morning, and it was said to me that the commission was meeting and that it was probably not going to get passed. Mm-hmm. So I immediately called our mayor, who unfortunately for him gave me his cell number. So he was driving on the expressway, and I expressed my opinions to him. My second call was to Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State University, who had several people also sitting on this commission. And I then called every other one of the commissioners who were going to be sitting there, and I said, I will be waiting in my office breathlessly. Please do not disappoint me. Every one of those people said to me, Diane, you only care about Latin American art. Why do you care about this? And I said, I care about my city. And everything about my city should be involved with art and culture. So please don't disappoint me. And I was the one who was so excited at the end of the day when it was finally passed. So bravo for you for sticking with the program.
That's cool.
Thank
fantastic.
You. That's political process. No. But now I see the unseen forces at work.
But I love the contrast of the $26,000 budget, the 2 point whatever it was,
five,
at the worst moment in the economy, and both of these becoming such community stories. I mean, it's a very exciting. I mean, public art is not as controversial as it was in those days in the 70s when it was really new. And it has become a huge educator in art. I see other questions coming up, and I know that this is going to be You have a comment before we call on the striped shirt?
Just to say that what you said about being an educator, I mean, that, like, Janet has one way of going about it. I have a very different way. And I feel that the artist is the educator. And there's something might be put before the public in it, and this monument becomes a talisman in a way. It has powers, but it's not one that are democratic powers. You can choose to like it or you can choose not to like it. But if it becomes part, my favorite place to put public art is on a university, because these students are seeing it year in and year out. And at the end of that, they have in their system, they've acquired this information in their system. They may not know what it is, but it does influence everything that they do. I really don't look for the approval of the masses because of the community, because the community is, to me, is undefinable. It changes at every moment. You don't know who's running what the newspaper is. So I think that as an educator,
you didn't know about Diane.
I didn't know about Diane. We depend on you, though. You are pivotal. But the idea that I see the artist as an educator, I see them as a gift giver, and I see them as something that is set apart from that approval process to some degree, without arrogance, but all the cues in a good public work are there. All the things that draw you in and give you what are the most enriching things about good public art are in the good ones. And so as an educator, mm-hmm. I see that as a very kind of singular focus.
A quick comment and then the striped shirt.
As an artist, I feel it's my responsibility to create a work which is both a sophisticated artwork which dialogues with the history of my craft, and at the same time that someone who's never studied art or art history can feel that they are that it's completely accessible to them. And that's a hard thing to do. It's a challenge. And the way that I do that, because it's about the experience of being there, everyone has equal access to that kinesthetic experience. And it's important to me that no one feel that this is some kind of a joke being played on them, you know. And that's very important. And so that I strive to have the work be both literal, you know, it is just what it is, but at the same time, those who are able and want to see additional layers in it can find that.
It has to be said that because arts education is not really a big feature of our curricula in the United States, that a lot of people are introduced to art for the first time through these public artworks. So they are educations. And I've heard people say, but I didn't realize that was art. I do like that. Hmm. But I thought art was something else. Now the stripes shirt. That's you.
A comment and then a question. One, I think that's as what's interesting is I'm a woman painter and technologist, CEO, and I always remind people that the root word for technology is technos, which is weaving, and women were the first technologists. So I think your work brings the two together, which I think brings me to the next point. In the work that we do in technology to create experiences, large experiences. Sometimes I'm the creator, sometimes my colleagues are. But we would never name ourselves. We would always name the ensemble because it's an ensemble work. So I find it interesting, you know, why you make choices to name yourself as the artist as opposed to the ensemble. Mm-hmm. And how do you think about that?
Jenna?
I think making art at this scale is a team sport. There's just no question that it's an ensemble. I list the name of each person who works on it, and without each of them, I cannot imagine being able to do it. Just like a work of architecture by Frank Gehry is not possible without every member of his studio and engineering firm.
And his computer.
And the technology and the technologists who wrote the software. I mean, I completely think of it as an ensemble work. In the end, I have to hold responsibility for the form and its content and its effect. And so I have to take that responsibility.
But so does the CEO, and yet I have to, I would never name myself as the artist. I would name a bigger name.
The company.
A larger ensemble with a different name as the artist, with myself as the keeper. Mm-hmm. Something to think about. Mm-hmm.
It may have something to do with how far an artist gets out on a limb before this question even pops up. I mean, as probably nobody would have wanted to be on Guy's masthead when he was out there being tarred and feathered, so.
Well, nobody wants to be, I mean, as a startup CEO, you're pretty far on the limb before, before people find
it. It's an interesting point. Question here.
I'm reminded of an artist whose name is Bernard Vinet, and Bernard just had a piece, as an aside, which was put up in Nice right now. But Bernard had a commission to do a piece along a highway where he did this steel arc that went through the highway, and the man who did the commission, this probably wouldn't be the case with a public commission, but the man who did the commission wanted the piece painted a different color, and that was the end of the commission. So I'm wondering what you both feel in terms of pressure put on you to do one thing or another once the commission has been given.
Guy, what would you say about that?
Good question, Murray. There is, I always see it there as there are rules, and I have a volume knob, and if a commissioning body or agent comes to me, they can say everything and all things, and I will listen. At a certain point, in my rule book, I turn it down, and there are things that will impinge on the work that will ultimately, you know, I can't, you can't really offend me, okay, because I'm not going to do what you want me to do, because that's your idea. I suggest you paint it, you make yours, and we'll be fine, but if that's the condition to do the work, then we really don't have an agreement. I think it's so important that artists are treated as absolute individuals. It's, to me, it is ultimately a team sport in the erection of the work and putting it together, but actually it's very singular, it's very individual, and it's, and I can, I think, and I can, I can't really find another profession that is not a profession that doesn't collaborate. And I think an artist cannot collaborate unless they're a collaborative artist. I mean, the Starn twins, they do that, and that's great. But an artist do get together on occasion. However, I still, I'm so old school that, and I love to listen to Janet because she is that way. She's absolutely singular. It's her vision that she sees that has to be there. And but she's absolutely of a different generation. And she sees it as a team sport, but ultimately, no, this is Janet's work.
How would you take the question? Would you paint it the requested color?
My art is not art by committee. You know, the vision does have to, we know what happens when you design by committee. It's built by ensemble, but the vision has to be singular. I am a pragmatist, and there are, I have to be very clear about which issues I can make compromise on and which ones I feel are so central to my vision that if I were to have to compromise there, I would withdraw. And so I do make compromises, and I think that's part of why all my pieces get built. An example in Phoenix was that the city was afraid that people would trip over the foundations, which could have been very, very elegant and less than a foot tall. But the city made me have 5-foot tall foundations at the base of the structure. In the end, I decided it was worth getting the piece built because that was a compromise I didn't like, but I was willing to make. There were other compromises they asked for, which I could not do. So I think that's what living in the world one learns. And I think being clear of my vision and then when I draw a line, they respect it because they know I've been willing to work with them on other issues. In Portugal, this piece, the structure they wanted, they didn't like my painting them like smokestacks. I think they didn't want to highlight their industrial aspect. They wanted to paint them black, and it was very strong. They kept saying, we'll move forward, but they must be black. And what I said was, let's paint them the way I designed it, and in 2 years, if you feel the public is opposed to it, then we'll reconsider. And you know,
you've never looked
back. The rest
back.
Is history.
I have a footnote to that, just very quickly. When I first started having marble done in in Italy. I was a little worried, like, are we going to get along? And then it dawned on me, they've been doing this for 600 years. They're the engineers and the carvers of the marble. I'm the artist. There's a guy in my studio. He's been with me 26 years. He would no more talk about the design of anything than, you know, he'll let it sit there for, you know, 2 years. That's my job. I'm the artist. He's the welder.
Mm-hmm. And we respect.
That's right.
When the engineer says you can't build it that way,
yeah,
I listen.
Right.
our time's up, but do we have time for that last question across? No,
I think we should probably end now so people can get off to the next session. So thank you, Guy Dill. Thank you, Janet Eckelman. Thank you, Dale Chatfield Taylor.
Thank you.
You're right. We need like 5 seconds.